Mentoring Solutions Proprietary Limited does not hold an Australian financial services license and does not purport to offer or provide financial advice. The information contained in this recording does not constitute specific financial, accounting, tax, legal, or other similar type advice. We strongly recommend that you liaise with your own financial, legal, accounting, and other advisors to ensure that the concepts contained herein can be tailored to your specific needs. Mentoring Solutions Proprietary Limited does not accept liability for any loss, damage or expense incurred by you if you rely on or utilise any of the methods, techniques or ideas discussed within this recording.
Hi and welcome to today's special webinar. I'm Simon Buckingham, joined today by results coach Lynn Buckingham. Hi Lynn.
Hi Simon, hello everyone.
And joined virtually over the phone by results coach Brendan Kelly. Come in Brendan.
Hello one and all.
We have a webinar to do today and a number of people have joined us for this, so welcome one and all. It will be a fairly packed hour that we're going to go for today. Our intent today is to have, first of all, a bit of a look at what's happening in the property market at the moment. As seems to be the case with regularity at present, there's a lot of conflicting information out there, a lot of fear and anxiety about what is happening in the property market, so we'll try and cut through some of that. And then we want to talk about what it is that, in our experience, having coached over 1,200 people now through the results program, in our experience, what it is that really makes the difference between people who become truly successful investors and those who perhaps give it a shot or maybe even never get around to giving it a shot and just fall away. And it's a very interesting topic. It is a topic near and dear to our hearts, and there's a lot to talk about there. I'm hopeful that everybody will find it of great value. So we would encourage everyone listening to this live to type questions into the chat window on the webinar room as we go. If you do have questions, we will do our best to answer as many as possible in the available time. So don't hold back. Please fire off your questions as we go and we'll try and deal with those. Now let's turn first of all to the property market and what's been happening recently. If you take a bit of a look at the latest statistics that have come out from sources like, for example, a good one is the RP Data or RISMARC Home Price Index. And if you're interested in seeing those stats raw, then go to www.rpdata.com. And you'll be able to find those reports. But what's been a bit of a trend in recent months has been a general flat level of growth, in fact, no growth, across most of the main centres. So if you look at what's been happening in the capital cities, particularly Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane and the ACT over September, you see only very small capital growth in those cities. And the other capitals are slightly down. If you go back a little bit further and look at the trend over the last 3 months, we see that the main centres are essentially flat for the quarter, but Perth is quite soft. It's down about 4% compared to either small increases or small decreases in the other centres. So the overall view is one of the property market not really going anywhere, just meandering along, doing not a lot in terms of capital growth anyway. Now, that's the capital cities, and obviously that's not all of Australia. If we look further afield and look at the regions, the regional areas around Australia actually make up about 40% of housing in Australia. So they shouldn't be dismissed. It's quite a statistically significant part of the overall property market. But that 40% of total housing is underperforming even more. And overall, we've seen about a 1.5% fall in values with little or no growth generally over 2010. So you'd read that and you'd go, oh my goodness, this is all very gloomy. And please don't misunderstand where we're going with this. This is not intended to put people off property or property investing at all or to paint a very gloomy picture. But what we want to do is look at what the market reality is right now. How is the market behaving right now? And as smarter investors, we want to then adapt our strategies accordingly. So we look at what the market's doing now. We attempt to predict where the market may be headed in the next year or so. and we need to modify our strategies rather than necessarily trying to do the same things we might have been doing, say, 12 or 24 months ago when the market was very different and many of the main centres were experiencing quite a boom. Are there things that are happening at the moment that are affecting the market that we should consider briefly? Interest rates went up last week, so unless you've been hiding under a rock, you'll have noticed that. And in fact, you'll have noticed that the big four banks all put their rates up by far more than the Reserve Bank put the cash rate up. So the Reserve Bank put forward a 0.25% or 25 basis point increase in the cash rate, which is one of the sources of money that affects the cost of money to the banks and therefore the cost of money to us as consumers. But off the back of that, on Melbourne Cup Day, on a holiday of all things, the Commonwealth Bank of Australia immediately jumped and put up rates by 0.45%, so not quite double the Reserve Bank increase. And then the other banks watched all of the media circus around that and the fallout and held back for a little while, I think, just to see how the dust was going to settle. But it didn't really affect their approach. And as we were almost expecting, the ANZ and then the NAB and then Westpac all put up their rates by more than the Reserve Bank as well. So the ANZ went up by 0.39%, the NAB went up by 0.43%, and Westpac was the lowest of the four, going up by 0.35%, but already their variable rates are one of the higher ones amongst the lenders anyway. So overall, they've all gone further than the RBA, and a lot of people got up in arms about that, and it's been a great political football to kick around. But all of the emotion around it is not really relevant to us as investors. We simply have to adapt to the market realities, and the market reality is a higher rate of interest. Now, if you've been reading the newsletters we've been putting out recently, in the one that we sent out at the end of last week, we suggested that you might want to head down to your local bank and have a go at negotiating a lower rate, and that might help offset some of the increase that's coming. And there's no reason for you not to ask for that. The pricing departments in the banks have a discretion, particularly around customer retention, to discount rates. And even if you're on a professional package of some sort that's already getting a discounted rate, that's not necessarily the lowest rate you could get if you just ask. So we would suggest that everyone should always be trying to get the best rate that they can. And if you don't ask, you don't get. So give it a shot. Now, what's the outlook for interest rates then? Well, we anticipate further modest increases in rates in the first half of the year. We don't believe that we've seen the last of rate increases for the time being. And that's due in part to recent information that's coming out around employment and wages. And in fact, some figures out today from the Melbourne Institute and their wages report for November show that total wage growth is actually accelerating. So we have total pay rising 5.0% over the 12 months to November 2010, and that's a higher rate of growth compared to the last report a quarter ago, which only showed about 4%. So if we see wage growth continue to accelerate, then that gives people more money, which means they can go out and spend more or borrow more. And that would be a warning indicator for the Reserve, which, as we've seen, the Reserve Bank will tend to act these days more proactively than reactively. And if they're concerned about pressure being put on inflation because wages are inflating and people have more money to spend, therefore there's more demand possibly than supply of goods and services and prices get bid up, then they'll act sooner rather than later to put up rates. Now, the other side of this also is the number of people in work. So not only is the growth in the wages that people are getting, but the number of people who are actually getting wages is also growing. And we've seen some recent statistics, and again, if you're reading the newsletters, you'll have some idea of this. But you'll have seen that the number of people in employment has been going up, and going up at quite a decent rate. So you combine those things together, more people in work and earning money and more people earning more money, then you have the possibility of further pressure on inflation and therefore a reason for the Reserve Bank to continue to increase rates next year. Now, we don't anticipate another rate rise necessarily in December. It's always possible, but we think with the higher than Reserve Bank increases passed on by the banks from the November cash rate increase, that we're unlikely to see the Reserve act again in December. They'll be on holiday in January, And that then takes us through to February as the earliest realistic review of interest rates. So we'll certainly be watching the February meeting with keen interest, and would recommend that everybody listening to this does too. But even in the absence of that, you ought to be budgeting in future rate rises into your numbers when you're looking at your property deals, and make sure that you'd be happy with the cash flows if rates were a percentage point or two higher than they are today. Now, if we look at what's going on in the market and this current trend of essentially flat growth, we have interest rates that have increased and may well increase again leading into next year. What's the application of all this for us as investors? Well, we need to think about how we should be investing and how we should be driving our profits. And therefore, if you're only focused on one aspect of your investing, say capital growth, then I'd be suggesting that you can't really rely on growth for profits in the short term. Now, the short term is really, say, the next 6 months or so. There are a number of factors that suppress demand, and if you look at what drives property values, it's really more the demand for property than the supply for property. And you want to therefore look at aspects that either stimulate demand, that make people want to go out and buy property, and aspects that suppress demand, that will cause people to hold off buying property or not to buy property. If we look at what is currently suppressing demand, so why do we have flat prices at the moment? Well, it's currently suppressed by the fact that we did have a rapid rise in recent times, and that rapid rise has outstripped the rate at which wages have been going up, and therefore you have a situation where we've gone from property being very affordable to being less affordable, so the market in a sense needs a breather. We have the situation where interest rates have just gone up, and they have been going up, so that makes people worried about where rates may end up and therefore a little bit fearful about investing. It also makes money more expensive, borrowing more expensive, and that can price some people out. The fear of future rate rises is more of an emotional or sentiment driver that might cause people to hold off investing. And we have ongoing global jitters. So Greece was in the news again today with concerns about its ability to control its debt levels. They're running, I think, 2.5 times as high as the European Union wants to see them. So whilst there's no real sign that the EU and the International Monetary Fund will stop bailing Greece out, there's increasing pressure on Greece to come good on its promises to cut back. Now, that instability on the level of a sovereign country and its ability to manage debt obviously has a ripple effect through the global financial markets, and we could see that if it was to deteriorate further, having an impact, a flow-on impact into economies and property markets. So there's all these global jitters, and despite constant debate around the topic, we also keep seeing talk about Australia having or not having a bubble. And enough people are on the side of the equation that believe that there is a bubble in Australia's property market to, again, take some of the demand heat out of the market and cause people to sit on their hands rather than act and buy property. So when you combine all that together, it's not really a surprise that we see a flat market at the moment. But that's today. So the real question is, well, if we look forward, what's coming? Is there another boom around the corner? Is there a crash around the corner?
Go on to that, if I may interject for a moment.
Please do.
You suggested you can't rely on growth for profits in the short term. When you say can't rely on growth, what are you talking about? Active growth, or are you talking about market-driven growth?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and there is a difference, of course. So passive growth is really market-driven growth. So it's the saying that all ships go up on a rising tide or rise on a rising tide. If the market is generally going up, then whilst every area and pocket will be slightly different, you might expect some general growth in the value of your property because everything's going up in value. That's passive growth. Active growth, on the other hand, is manufactured. You build in an increase in the value of your property by adding some kind of value. Brendan, examples?
Renovation, subdivision developments, any form of creative add value by for cash flow means, potentially by way of increasing the number of heads, or if you find a property with two properties on one title, subdividing that off, selling them as individual properties, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, exactly right. So we're not talking about the active growth when we say don't rely on growth. That's manufactured, that's more inside your control. The passive growth or the market-driven growth is not inside your control. And you know, you should never battle against the trend. And if the trend is currently flat or soft or negative, then you know, buying something and expecting it to go up in value tomorrow is a bit of a fool's game, and certainly not something that we'd advocate. You also need to bear in mind that as soon as you buy something, you're already on the back foot because you've sunk in a whole lot of closing costs like stamp duty and conveyancing costs and possibly inspection reports or initial repairs that you've yet to catch up before you're making any money through growth as well. So that could be 5% of your property value that you've got to recover in growth before you're even ahead.
On the flip side, if you sell it too, there's usually commission fees, et cetera, which adds another 3%. So you'd really need to cover 8 to 10% of your purchase value just to break even.
Yeah, so going into a property where you're behind by 5 or 8% to begin with, in a flat market that where values aren't really going anywhere, does that sound like a great investing strategy? And then add in on that you might have negative cash flows on the property as well that you've got to support. It doesn't sound all that hot.
So can I back your statement that a passive growth, a market-driven growth strategy for the short term where you intend to sell within 6 months is just not a market that's designed for great success in that strategy?
No, this is not a flipper's market, certainly. A flip being where you buy a property, try to get some short-term market-driven gains and flick it on before too long has gone past. So, again, it sounds a bit gloomy, but remember, this is one strategy. This passive growth strategy is only one way to invest, and there are so many different ways to invest. And if you're subscribing to our newsletter, you'll be very well aware that there are a variety of different ways to go here. But what's very interesting for us is as we watch the market and we look forward to try and see what's happening or what's coming in the near future, there are a number of factors that are starting to come together and they paint a very interesting picture. On the fundamental level, we have a growing population. So we have more people who presumably need places to live, so they've either got to rent or buy. And so as the population increases, if the supply of housing as new houses available for people doesn't increase at a rate to accommodate that growth, then you have this underlying pressure that builds and builds and builds, which eventually has to translate either to outrageously high rents or pressure on housing prices. And indeed, we do see this time and again, that we're just not adding enough supply into the market for the population growth that we've got. Now, again, we're in a flat market, so why aren't we getting that growth? Well, a number of those factors suppressing demand at the moment are responsible. Other factors that are coming together, though, so if we've got this base level of population that's certainly not shrinking and we're not making enough houses to accommodate them, yet start to add into that some other factors. So we have improving economic confidence. It's being said a lot lately that if you want to be anywhere or any economy in the world right now, you'd want to be Australia. So there's improving economic confidence, and growth in Australia is relatively strong. And off the back of that, there's a lot of positive sentiment. People feel more confident about their futures and about being in property. We see issues around affordability, particularly as interest rates go up or following the recent price rises that we did see 12 or 24 months ago in most of the main centres. But the main affordability issue isn't actually the prices and people's ability to afford the debt on those. It's really their ability to save for a deposit. So if you need 20% of a $500,000 house for your deposit, that's $100,000. And most people really struggle in our current culture to save that sort of money. And so particularly coming out of the global financial crisis, where loan-to-value ratios or the amount of a property's value that you're allowed to borrow dropped, and you had been able to get 95% or even 100% loans, that got pulled back to 90% as a hard ceiling by most lenders during the GFC, we've now started to see the re-emergence of higher percentage LVRs again. Now, we did do another webinar around the whole affordability issue, so if you want to delve into this and our views on the reality or lack thereof of a real affordability problem in Australia, then go back to the Sophisticated Property Investor newsletters at resultsmentoring.com/SPI, and look for the newsletter dated 29 September, and you'll find a link to a recording which outlines our views on affordability. But a key point is that we are seeing the re-emergence of these higher percentage loans. And so if suddenly you don't need 20% or a 10% deposit, you only need a 5% deposit because you can get a 95% loan again, then you need to have saved a lot less. And that makes a property more affordable or easier for somebody to save enough for, to buy, to have enough of a deposit to buy. And with that re-emerging and becoming more mainstream, that reduces the need for these higher deposit savings. So that's interesting as well. So that opens up property to a wider range of people who might otherwise have been priced out just by the amount of a deposit they'd need. We're also seeing rising rents at the moment, and particularly while prices are flat, if rents go up, the yield or the rental return on a property starts to go up. And that makes property more attractive to investors and speculators. Potentially, depending on how interest rates go, as rents rise, you may need less of your own money to support a property in terms of holding it for the long term. So that, again, makes property potentially more affordable to investors or more attractive to investors. We're also seeing this flat trend in prices giving incomes a chance to catch up. So whilst prices ran a bit ahead of where incomes were over the last 18 months, the prices have now flattened off. But as I mentioned earlier in the webinar, the figures out today are showing that rate of increase in wages is starting to ramp up again. So with flat prices giving incomes a chance to catch up and maybe overtake, we get housing becoming more affordable. And more people in jobs means more people can afford to buy property too, as we mentioned before. So if we're looking for what may trigger the next real run on property prices, the next real boom, and if we're looking for what might offset the possibility of a real downturn in property, we start to look at all these factors coming together. And individually, you might look at any one of these factors and say, well, okay, that's interesting, but on its own, it doesn't necessarily mean much. You put these together and you start to see a very potent brew bubbling away under the surface, and in our view, that has to translate into growth in property values in the not-too-distant future. So the key thing to watch if you're looking for what is really going to push the button on the next property boom, in our opinion, would be wages growth. So the last boom came off the back of wage growth that was around about 10% per annum. Now, we're currently tracking around 5%, but increasing, then you want to watch that very closely and expect increasing activity in the property market if wage growth gets closer to double digits. So as we start to go up 7%, 8%, that's going to put some real pressure, I think, on property values, and certainly is going to help to offset the modest increases in interest rates that we would expect to happen over the next 6 months or so.
A thought around that too is that the RBA would obviously be very, very tuned to that sort of growth and may in fact be talking similarly around further interest rate rises to negate inflation. But that doesn't mean that property prices still won't climb. If people are confident and confident in excess of, if I step back for a minute, it's like a balancing equation. Property alone doesn't drive inflation and property alone doesn't drive interest rates, but interest rates are a very powerful way of controlling the rate of cash or the amount of cash in an economy. If we're at a point where the confidence in the Australian community around property exceeds the rate at which inflation is going, it won't matter how much the number of increments or the size of the increments so much for the interest rates at any one point, the sentiment will exceed it, and therefore property prices will continue to climb, in my mind, and that's the phase we're heading into, above the rate at which the rate of inflation will grow. Does that sound reasonable to you?
Yeah, look, I agree, Brendan. I think one of the biggest drivers, certainly in the short-term spikes of growth that you see, because property never increases at a constant rate, and it goes down from time to time, and it's flattened other times. But one of the biggest things that triggers a spike is the sentiment side of things. It's the confidence, the emotion. Human beings are emotional beings, and if they feel confident about their job security, about the fact that they've just got a massive 10% wage increase, the Reserve Bank or their own bank putting up interest rates by 0.25% or 0.5% in a hit isn't necessarily going to detract too much from that. Yes, it might mean they need to rein in their expectations around what they can afford, but again, you look at, well, there are a whole lot of factors coming together here. I need less of a deposit, so I keep more of my own cash. I can get a 95% loan. I can borrow more because my wages have gone up. You combine all of these things, and that can make for someone very positive and less impacted by gradual increases in the interest rates. I think if you saw a dramatic hit on the interest rates, so 0.75% increase or a 1% increase in a very short space of time, then sure, that can take away from that positive sentiment. It can make people fearful and worried about affordability and so on.
Absolutely.
And because of that, while we're reasonably bullish about the market going into 2011 and anticipating growth to ramp up, particularly in the second half of 2011, we never invest in blind optimism or in ignorance of the risks. And there are still risks. You know, interest rates going up is a risk. The global uncertainties are a risk. And you don't want to just blind yourself to that and say, well, I'll just go out and buy anything because maybe in 12 months' time the value will be higher. That's just silly. You want to avoid relying solely on market-driven gains. You don't want to make that your be-all and end-all because it exposes you to risks that are outside your control. And really, sophisticated investing is all about maximizing the control that you have over your profit outcome. And so abdicating your responsibility to the market or blaming the market is just a cop-out. You want to be in control as much as you possibly can. Yes, be mindful of the market trends. Use them to your advantage. Don't fight against the trend. But don't rely solely on the trend for your profits either. Now, what else? What's the other application of what we're seeing or the current market that we're in and what we could be doing right now? Well, because the market is flat and indeed down in some areas, sellers are more fearful, and that gives you the opportunity as a potential buyer to negotiate hard. So we have a more buyer-friendly market that's emerged over the last few months. It's not as silly as it was. There'll always be exceptions, but generally speaking, it's not as silly as it was. Properties aren't achieving outrageously high prices at auction that are way above the reserve like they were a few months ago. So it's a more buyer-friendly market, and that gives you the opportunity to negotiate better deals. And as some good friends of ours are very fond of saying, if you don't ask, the answer is already no. So you might as well ask. The answer might still be no, but you might be able to negotiate a discount. So the answer could be yes, and you should be trying to negotiate hard. The pendulum has swung back in favour of the buyers a little bit in the current market.
So what are some of the things that people might want to look for then?
Sure. Well, as we've said, we don't want you to just go out and buy any old thing. And we don't want you to buy anything unless you know that it fits in with your financial goals. So don't buy any old thing just for the sake of getting into the market or just because it's more of a buyer's market at the moment. You want to look for certain elements around the property. So you need to consider your financial goals, but look for things like scarcity. What is inherently scarce or unique about this property that is going to mean it's in greater demand than other properties in the area, so it will outperform over time? Does it have ocean views? Does it have larger land in an area that's being infilled by developers? What is scarce or unique about it? Now, note we say scarce or unique, not weird. So you don't want the house that's actually right next door to a property that Lynn and I own that they built it back in the 60s in the shape of an igloo, unless you're going to just demolish it and build back on that land. So you want something that is scarce but not weird. Now, that's if you're more into the whole passive buy and hold growth thing. If you don't want to rely on market-driven growth, then you're looking for the ability to add value in some way. As Brendan mentioned before, the possibility of improving the property through renovation or subdividing the land or redeveloping the site, building something new. How can you add value to this so you're not just reliant on the market to deliver your gains? Or alternatively, positive cash flow. Can you buy something in a flat or down market that will actually pay for itself and allow you the luxury of holding the property irrespective of what happens to value without feeling any financial pressure? And then you can ride the cycles as the market picks back up again. So there are a number of strategies that we'd suggest people should be looking to use in the current environment rather than sitting back and doing what 99% of mum and dad investors out there will be trying to do, and that's just buy, hold and pray and hope it goes up in value in an environment where things aren't going up in value. So that's the strategy side of things, and really that's the discussion we wanted to have about the state of the market now, and leave you with our thoughts on that in terms of how you want to be looking to operate in this climate. Let's now turn our attention to what it takes to be a highly successful investor. And what we want to do is try and answer a couple of questions here. One is, why do so few people actually fail to get started in property investing in the first place? And for those who do get started in property investing, why do so few of those people ever own more than one or two properties? Most people end up owning just one, two, maybe three properties at a stretch, and they never get beyond that. Now, part of that is the strategies that people use. And we've talked a little bit about strategy in this webinar so far. You know, if you're sitting there holding a highly negatively geared property that's costing you $10,000 or $20,000 a year to hang on to, and you simply cannot afford to buy any more similar properties, well, there's part of the problem. It's the strategy you're using. And that strategy could limit your ability to do more than one or two property deals. Now, we've discussed that in past newsletters, so I'm not going to dwell on it too much. It's also discussed in our book that bookstores this month. Brennan, what's our book called?
The Real Deal, Property Invest Your Way to Financial Freedom.
Now, it's very exciting to see that. Just as an aside, that's actually been chosen as, is it Money Magazine's Book of the Month for December, Brennan?
I think it is.
Which is just fantastic. So, again, you'll find a lot of discussion about the strategy side of things in the book and in past newsletters. If we look, though, it's the old 80-20 rule of 20% of something, 80% of another. Really, if you look at what makes an investor successful, 20% of it is the strategy and the effort that's put in. 80% of it's your attitude, or to use a more fluffy word, your mindset. But really, your attitude. Now, what we've seen amongst the people that we've coached and other people that we know who are investing or trying to invest is that most people will give up at the first sign of resistance because their reasons for investing simply aren't strong enough. Brendan, do you see that a lot?
Yeah, I do. If you think of a small person approaching a pebble or a rock, they can get over it. But a small person approaching a boulder or a mountain is going to find that hard to get over. Now, if you don't have a big enough why or a big enough reason to keep going, something that you're dedicated to or committed to or a dream you're looking to satisfy, it, you know, not quite at any cost, but without paying some sort of price to achieve, then you'll start walking up this huge mountain and go, you know what, this is too tough and the prize isn't worth it. Yeah, I'm not that committed to it. I'm comfortable where I'm at. I'm not that inspired by it. Life is okay. I'm not doing too miserable, and you start to rationalize, well, you know, this is getting tough, and I'm not really miserable. And what I want is just so far away. I don't have to do it today. I can do it tomorrow. But what they then tend to do is slip into a trap of, you know what, later. You know what, it's not that important, or I'm comfortable, and therefore they give up. You know, they just walk away and say, yep, later, it's okay, tomorrow's fine.
But it never is it?
No. People ultimately end up with always living out of tomorrow and then finally get to the day that tomorrow comes and live with regret from the past. It's funny how people don't tend to live in the moment or don't tend to create a sense of urgency for themselves, a sense of commitment for themselves around, this is a non-negotiable in my life. This is something that has to happen for me because I can see consequence. I'm feeling the consequence now of not having achieved it. I'm living out of a sense of anxiety that I'm not achieving it now, and the road I'm going down is leading somewhere that I really don't want to end up. And to a certain extent, using fear or using even greed's the wrong word, but a sense of the size of the prize or a sense of reward to inspire you as opposed to stop you.
That's a very good point. And in our time in coaching people, we get to hear all the excuses as well, because people will tend to blame something for the reason why they haven't achieved or why they can't try. Lynn, what are some excuses that you would have heard over the years from people who, you know, reasons why, oh, I can't be a successful investor because, or I can't go out and buy 10 properties in the next 5 years because of X? Mm. What sort of things?
Yeah, we have heard many, many excuses. Low income, new baby, oh, I'm just too busy, I don't have any savings, oh, I just can't find a deal, I've looked but I can't find a deal, I don't know what to look for. I don't know where to start.
Yeah, there's lots of things. Off the back of the new baby, I'm too tired from personal experience.
Yeah, been there.
But yeah, and others, you know, we'll get people who say, oh, the market's different now. You know, you can't do what you used to be able to do, or it's the wrong time to buy because prices are going up too fast, or prices are going down, or property's too expensive. All sorts of things. Brendan, I think you get, from time to time, one of the ones you mentioned to me, oh, my friends or family won't support me, is something that you'll hear from time to time.
Yeah, there is some... again, it's funny. I love this sort of stuff. So if I prattle on, just cut me off. But it's amazing how people that people trust most, they're most vulnerable to. And quite logically, that makes sense. Someone, if you trust someone, you love them, like your parents, your mum, your dad, your brothers, your sisters. If you have a great respect for those people, your defences against what they say is down. And therefore, you take what they say to heart very easily. You're vulnerable to their own idiosyncratic type approaches to life. Well, if you take off on a branch that's different to them, their immediate reaction is, so what are you doing and why? You know, what's this all about? And you idiot. And because of that vulnerability, people who start on a journey of financial freedom for themselves, a journey that's going to get them into a better financial position than what they are now, that is different to their friends or different to their loved ones, is going to face some resistance, and they are extremely vulnerable to that. So one of the ones particularly is your spouse. If you have a dream or a desire to have your life, your family life be better and your partner's not on board, you're potentially up for a bit of pain and a few hard conversations. So, yeah, there is resistance out there from the most unlikely and unsuspecting sources, and it knocks you for a six. But again, it comes back to the commitment to your dream and your goal. And provided you continue to work on it, but work on it rationally rather than irrationally, or not blind faith but learned, you keep going. You will succeed. But people often come up and say, my mate told me, and now I don't believe you. Or my mate told me such and such, and I'm really struggling with this. There is resistance in the most unlikely places.
Mm. We might come back and touch on that a little bit later on in the webinar as well, but it's a very good point. I mean, all of this boils down to some excuse as to why it can't be done, you know, why I can't go out and buy that property, or why I can't go out and become financially free, some sort of excuse. But whatever the excuse, I think in the time that we've been investing ourselves, and certainly over the number of people that we've coached, we could probably show you someone who's getting it done regardless. Whatever the excuse. Whatever excuse you can come up with, we probably can show you somebody who's doing it anyway. And all of those excuses that we've mentioned seem to boil down to essentially four categories, and what we call the four fatal excuses. So category one is money, either low savings or low income. I can't do it because I don't have enough money. Category two is time. In other words, I don't have enough time, I'm too busy. Category three is knowledge or ignorance. Category four is the relationships that Brendan's mentioned, you know, the unsupportive relationships or the naysayers in your circle who try to get in the way. And what we want to do on the balance of this webinar is really run through these four areas and show you, well, actually, these excuses are phantoms. They can all be overcome. Let's start with money. And break it down into low savings or low income. And some people listening to this are going to identify with one or other of these categories.
Simon, sorry, why are we breaking it down into low savings or low income?
Just for simplicity of explanation. Now, people will need a couple of things in order to buy a property. One is money for a deposit and possibly for costs, like if you're going to improve the property. So that's where's that money going to come from? For most people, that tends to come from savings. The other side of it is, okay, and you're probably going to want to borrow some money because it's unlikely that you're going to pay cash outright for a property that you're going to buy. So you have to trot off down to the bank and get a loan. What do you need to support a loan? Income. So if you're on a low income or have low savings or both, you can throw up all these excuses as to why you can't be done. I couldn't get a bank loan. I can't get enough of a loan. Or I haven't saved enough for a deposit, so I can't do it. I can't try. All these reasons start to bubble up, and they're all obstacles, those pebbles or rocks or boulders or mountains that you mentioned earlier, Brendan, that can get in your way if you lack the commitment to your goal. So let's take a look at each of these in turn. So starting with low savings, one of the ladies that I'm coaching in the program at the moment, her name's Gladys, and she also features in the book, amazing lady, not because she's extraordinary and different to other people or made up somehow chemically different from other people. She wasn't born different to anyone else who's listening to this. She's amazing because of the number of excuses that she could potentially have to stop her moving forwards and the fact that she just goes forwards anyway. So Gladys is a migrant to Australia. English is her second language. She's originally from South America. She earns a low income. She does foster care for a job. So that obviously doesn't earn you a six-figure consultant salary or anything like that. It's fairly low income. and she's on a couple of benefits. Now, Gladys would have every reason not to do property investing. You know, I'm on a low income, I can't afford it. If I'm on this sort of income, I can't save enough of a deposit. English is my second language, I can't make myself understood by agents. Well, who can? But there are so many reasons why she might decide not to go ahead, but she goes ahead anyway. Unlike many people listening to this who will be on six-figure incomes, Gladys on her low income puts aside $1,000 to $2,000 a month in savings. Now, how many people listening to this webinar can honestly put hand on heart and say they're capable of doing that? Well, you are. That's not a question of your income. It's a question of your discipline, your ability to budget, and your willingness to sacrifice. And all three of these things are things that, because Gladys's goals are important enough to her, she's committed herself to. So she's extremely disciplined with her budgeting. She prepares a budget every month, accounts for every piece of expenditure, and plans all of her expenditure for the coming month as well. So
is that easy to do, though, Simon? I mean, as you mentioned people on the webinar who might be struggling to do that, and it's a struggle for a reason. Is it easy to do?
Look, I think technically budgeting's easy to do. The challenge is applying it to your real life. You know, it's not hard to sit down with a piece of paper or a spreadsheet and actually map out, well, what do I think I'm going to spend money on and what am I not going to. It might take time to get an understanding of that. I think that the real challenge, though, is the discipline and the ability to then choose what you can sacrifice out of your budget that is less important to you than achieving your financial goals.
Now, sacrifice itself is by definition a requirement for experiencing some pain, yes?
Yes, correct.
So if people are out there listening to this and trying to identify with Gladys or trying to identify with, okay, I get it that I need to save or budget, but it's just so hard. You don't understand my life. I've got expenses that are coming out of my proverbial. I'm always hit with things that I don't expect. There are some big bills coming up. I've just had this circumstance occur in my life. You just don't get it. From their perspective, they're living that reality, and I can fully understand the... Yeah, but you don't understand in the whole sense of shock horror type, I'm going to have to face some pain here.
Yep.
If I'm going to make this happen. But is it a necessary pain?
Yeah, look, I think it is. I think that you need to figure out what's important to you. Are there things in your current lifestyle that are nice to haves, not need to haves? For us, Lynn, we think back to when we started investing. You know, we lived beyond our means. We had, I bought my car on the worst possible form of credit. We would go out, well, I, perhaps not so much Lynn, but I would, you know, even look across the desk here. I was the guy who loved to buy the gadgets, the latest, you know, iPods, or, well, they weren't iPods in my day, but, you know, the latest bits of technology. And, you know, I was working long hours in a corporate job that I hated, so I felt that I was entitled, and I'd go out and spend. Now, here's a, very quickly, because I'm conscious of time on the webinar, but here's an exercise that I would encourage everybody to do on this, and you may want to come back to the recording and listen to this again later for the full instructions. But what you want to do is write down your after-tax take-home salary for the year. So once all the tax and super and everything's been taken out, what do you actually get to take home for a year? Then work out, on an average week, how many hours do you actually spend at your job, so physically at your job, plus getting to and from your job, plus all of that overtime that you don't necessarily get paid for, and any time over the weekend that you spend thinking about your job. How many hours in total? And for most people, it's going to be way more than 40. Figure that out. Multiply it by 52 for the year. And then take that after-tax amount that you're getting paid each year and divide it by that number of hours. And that will be your true hourly rate. Now, once you know your true hourly rate, and you might get a shock, you might decide you're better off just flipping burgers. No offense to anyone who flips burgers. But you might get a bit of a shock and decide, oh, gee, I didn't realize I was so poorly paid. But the point here then is you've now converted your time at work into a dollar amount. So every hour that you spend in work equates to a certain number of dollars. So next time you go out and you're tempted to make that impulse purchase for that new pair of shoes or the new iPhone or whatever it is, new car, new plasma screen TV, convert that price into the amount of time you've got to spend at work in order to earn back that money after tax.
Those hours you're referring to, or that price, refers to all hours, including travel time, including thinking time.
That's right, because that is how much time you've got to spend in that job that maybe you hate with a passion in order to pay for that thing. Now, do you really need that thing, or would you be better off saving that money and putting it into an investment that's going to help you to get out of that job?
So my encouragement then to people who are thinking, yeah, you don't understand my life, us, we have all done this. We have all gone through periods and patches in our lives where we've gone fairly frivolous with our finances to only realize at some point that that's not a path to financial freedom. And the only way you get to enjoy the money you get in life down the track is to put the pain in now. Mm. There is a price to pay, but it's okay. It's okay. You're not losing a limb. You're not sacrificing a finger, and you're not giving away your firstborn. It's just a matter of dealing with an element of discipline. But the hardest fight is the fight you have to face for yourself, the one against you.
Exactly right. Now, I'm going to go on to a question from the chat room in just a second, but before I do that, I just want to wrap up the point about Gladys. Having done this budgeting and sacrifice and saved, she was able to buy her first property and made $40,000 from one deal in 8 months. So you look at that sort of thing as an outcome for applying a little bit of discipline, making a few little sacrifices. Is it worth it? Well, I'm quite sure if you ask Gladys, she would unreservedly say yes. Now, coming to the question on the chat room, we have, I'm on a single parent pension. No way I can save or get a loan. I have the passion and the time to find a property deal to make money on. What advice would you have for me, perhaps to find somebody with the dollars and no time? Well, that's actually an excellent idea. And again, it's great. So well done, Kathy, for thinking outside the box on this and not just saying, well, I have an excuse not to try. One of the ways to get around not having your own money is for deposits or costs is to team up with somebody else. And we've all done that. All the people talking around this webinar have at some point or another in our investing teamed up with somebody else to make a deal happen rather than kiss the deal away because for whatever reason we were fully committed on other things or out of cash at that point in time or whatever. So finding a money partner or a joint venture partner of some sort to team up with as a way of overcoming an issue with savings or income is a great idea. You just want to make sure that you take the time to get to know the person properly, make sure that their goals are in line with yours, and you do a bit of due diligence on the person before you proverbially jump into bed with them on a property deal. And always make sure that everything's legally and correctly documented by a commercial lawyer to cover the risks around the arrangement. But certainly that is a great way to move forwards. And there are other creative ways. I think we've mentioned things like vendor carrybacks recently in some of the newsletters. So have a look back through those for some ideas as well. But, yeah, so it's a good on you, Kathy, for thinking outside the square on that. Turning now to the low-income question. Lynn, if somebody is on a low salary, so we talked about Gladys and she was able to overcome it. Do you have another example of someone on a low salary and how strategically they are able to address that and still find a way forwards?
Yeah, absolutely. We had a young girl in the program called Rachel. She also was in our book, and she's also recently just featured in Your Investment Property magazine, where she had an article on getting started on a low income. Rachel, I think, is 22, lovely girl, extremely positive attitude, and this, I think, has been part of why she's done extremely well. She won't accept no for an answer. She has sought the information that she needed. So she's gone out and asked for help. You know, she spent time with me as her coach, and that has really been the driving force behind her doing well as well. She knew what she wanted. She was looking for positive cash flow investment. Coming into the program, Rachel previously had one investment property, a rental, in New South Wales. Now, Rachel works part-time in a surfy shop. The rest of the time, she likes to go surfing. So she has the time on her hands. So as such, she needed to look for a deal that was going to help her to create cash flow.
Yeah, so the issue that she's facing being on a low income then is if she just rocks off down to a lender, they're going to give her a very, very low loan approval.
Yeah.
So she may still be able to buy something, but it's going to be very cheap, just off the back of her own income. But on the flip side, though, if the property itself generates an income, and if that income is more than the costs associated with holding the property, so the interest costs on the loan and the rates and the insurance and the other holding costs, property management fees and so on. If even on top of that it produces a positive cash flow, what's the bank going to think of that? Are they going to be less inclined or more inclined to lend her the money?
That's right. So with all that in mind, Rachel had the discipline to put together some savings, even on her part-time working. She specifically went out and looked for positive cash flow deals. So the deal that she ended up doing was a four-unit site, all rented out on long-term tenancies.
So it's four units on one title?
Four units on two titles, and the four units were all off to one side. So they actually all sat on one title, and what she actually found that she had, although she didn't specifically look for it, was a clear second title there, which down the track she has the potential to develop or on sell.
So hang on, let me get this right. So there are four units on one title.
Yep.
All rented, all producing cash flow in excess of the costs associated with holding this property with a loan on it. And she gets a block of land for free.
She got a block of land for free.
Yep. Nice.
Very nice.
So, again, we've got somebody here who has every excuse or every reason not to try, but looks at, well, how can I overcome these limitations? Okay, if I'm on a low income, strategically, what do I need? Well, maybe I need a property that's actually going to supplement my income rather than take away from it. So it wouldn't make sense for Rachel to go off and try and buy something that's negatively geared because she's not going to have the income to support it very easily, and nor is the bank likely to give her enough lending for it anyway. But on the other hand, if the property itself generates a positive cash flow, then it's easier for her to get the lending that she needs. And not only that, but it's helping her to achieve her financial goals of adding to her and ultimately replacing her income. I think this particular property generates enough cash flow, by my calculations, to net about a third of her current wages. So if she's happy to maintain her lifestyle at the level that it is now, then she's one third of the way to financial freedom already from one property deal. And one property deal that doesn't take away from her own income as it stands at the moment either.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, this whole conversation is centred around attitude. Rachel's attitude was to approach this differently. Rachel's attitude was to ask questions, ask, how can I solve the problem of replacing my income? How can I solve the problem of achieving financial freedom? Rather than the traditional way is to go and buy and hold negative geared properties, or, you know, to restrict my income. And the attitude to ask a different question, the attitude to have a crack at it and have a go at it and seek the right advice, has made the difference for her.
Indeed. So we looked at money as a category of excuse, either low savings or low income, and ways in which that can be attacked. What about the second fatal excuse, Brendan, time? If someone says they're too busy at work or they're time poor, that's often a reason for them not to get started.
Indeed it is, and that's one of the things that, you know, from time to time I think we've all faced. But there's a gentleman also appearing in the book, Adam. He had a 7 a.m., 7 p.m. type of job structure, and he was finding time really restrictive. But the commitment to want to find a deal still existed, so he created in his life the space and time to find one. He found the time to do a deal that netted over $300,000 in profit. He kind of liked what he was doing, but saw that there was something better he could be doing, something more he'd prefer to be doing with his time, and the trick was to get away to get into that. And what he's doing now, which is what he's loving doing, is investing and developing full time. So he had to make a change. He had to make a sacrifice in other things in his life, in his job, in his time management, some of the spoils and luxuries of television perhaps at the end of the day, or sports on a Sunday, or whatever it was that he was doing. He needed to make a time sacrifice that allowed him to create the space in his life to go and find a property that gave him $300,000. From my perspective, that's a worthwhile endeavor. If that's going to improve my financial position by $300,000, how many of these do I need to do in a year? How many of these do I need to do over 2 years in order to replace my income? I mean, if I had an income, let's say, of $100,000 to $150,000, and I did a $300,000 deal in 12 months, well, I've earned my income in a job and something I love doing that's consuming far less time than an exchange of time for dollars, and I've still got a lump sum available to me that's improving my cash and equity position. It's a great solution to keep going and live the life I want. And Adam had to do that. But he did, and he successfully completed a deal that allowed him to leave his job.
Yeah, now, if the people who are listening to this are thinking, well, yeah, I work 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., and I can't see how I could possibly fit this stuff in. Some ideas from personal experience, and Len or Brendan, feel free to chip in as well, but coming out of the corporate world and doing those long hours and you know, hating it and feeling tired at the end of every day, but wanting to make a difference enough that I was prepared to do whatever it took, that some of the things that I did to make time in my long days for my property were, well, you have to take breaks, right? If you're not taking breaks, you're going to die. So you better start taking breaks if you're not taking breaks already. But during your breaks, you could be making phone calls to real estate agents. You could be searching the net for property, starting to immerse yourself in property. We, Lynn, how often have we gone out and done evening appointments with real estate agents?
Yeah, all the time.
Yeah, we don't wait around for the open for inspection in 2 weeks' time to happen on a Saturday morning. We've got better things to be doing with our Saturday mornings. We would phone up about a property we were interested in and say, hey, look, I can't make your open. I'd like to inspect the property tomorrow night at 7 p.m. What do you say? And most agents, if they want to sell the property, they'll make the appointment. So, you know, don't feel constrained and always be prepared to ask and try to do things outside the box. So evening appointments, using our weekends. We did have to make a lot of sacrifices of weekend time. You know, we would spend time going on the road and going out, research new suburbs, meet agents to go out to satellite cities and see what was going on there, or even regional towns and have a look at properties. So there were sacrifices. You know, we had to give up going to the beach or going to the movies. Annual leave can be great to have a focused block of a week or two of time where you're just doing property stuff. And so, you know, we've done things like even jumping on a plane and going to New Zealand and running around the countryside. All of us, Brendan, jammed into the back of a tiny little car, but spending, you know, a limited amount of time, just a week on the ground, and getting some terrific results by doing that. It's that focused time. So you've got to make the time. It's not going to just suddenly drop a deal in your lap. You've got to go out there and make the time. You figure out where you can fit it in, what you're prepared to sacrifice. And, you know, if you want it enough, you will make the time. You'll find the time.
An additional idea may be that, you know, if you've accrued a lot of credibility or a lot of credit, so much, so to speak, in time or in value in the company, to approach your boss and say, listen, starting to wear a bit thin, am I able to take maybe an annual leave day every fortnight? Well, suddenly you've gone from a 12-day fortnight where you're working 7 to 7, 5 days and then stuff on the weekend into potentially, you know, with some commitment on your part to concentrate on cutting hours down or you know, cutting the level of dedication perhaps a little bit to create an extra day off out of a fortnight. Well, if you've got a day off out of a fortnight, that's a lot of time that you can throw towards doing a deal, finding a deal, learning about what needs to be done for deals and to increase the level of inspiration to keep going on it.
Yeah, I think a mistake people make or a mistaken assumption that people have about property investing is that they think they have to be able to do it full time. I don't think for any of us, Brendan, that was the case when we were starting out, that we were doing our property full time. We did it part time in and around our jobs.
Yep. Mm. And we don't encourage people to leave their jobs and just go, I'm going to be a full time investor now, bang, because you need an income. The banks are going to want to see some sort of capacity for you to pay a loan back. If you leave the work to say, woohoo, I'm a property investor now because I said so, banks are just going to kind of laugh and you might find it really tough to actually borrow money to buy a house.
Exactly right.
So yeah, it's a management of your time that's going to allow both of these things to exist, at least at the first stages in your life.
Indeed. Let's move on to the third fatal excuse then, knowledge or lack of experience, the I don't know how. Brendan, can you give us one example of someone who's overcome this and how they went about it?
Lovely, lovely lady by the name of Shilpa. She emigrated to Australia, 5 years ago now, had never bought a property before, was completely ignorant on what was required to buy a property, how to do it. She, you know, again, having only recently immigrated, didn't know Australian culture or our laws around buying property, and thought, I want to do something, I like property, tired of renting, I need to do something somewhere in my life, how about I have a crack at this? And in the program that she's enrolled in, we worked together on what she needed to know, went through all of the circumstances, went through all the procedures, the materials and stuff that we had available to her, helped train her and build her knowledge. She had to dedicate the time and the commitment to learning. The idea of "I don't know" was absolutely an excuse for her if she wanted to use it. She had every right to turn around and say, "You know what, I don't know what I'm going to do. It's all too hard and I don't get it and I'm just going to give up and think of something else. I'll go and buy a share and hope." The approach that has success for her was one to say, "You know what, not knowing is not an answer. Not knowing is simply an excuse, and if I dedicate myself to learning, if I throw some time at learning, then she will skill up." And she did. She, with no prior property experience at all, and never, as I said, never having bought her own home either, she did dedicate time to learn and to take action. Recently, over a, just concluded on a deal, in 18 months made $200,000. Now, that was more than the family income combined in a year. It was an extraordinary result. She did really, really well for the property that she purchased. It was a delightful property. She bought it. It was cash flow positive. It went up in value, and as a subdividable property, which she did, sold off the two properties. So she was being paid to hold and subdivide something and then paid to make a profit. It's a lovely deal. Very sweet. She did very, very well out of it. But she only did so because she learnt what needed to be done. She learnt the sort of deal that she was looking for. She learnt what needed to happen for her to buy it. She learnt what she needed in order to see the deal through. She learnt who to speak to and learnt from those conversations about how to make it happen, and did. She didn't use lack of knowledge. She didn't use a lack of experience as a reason not to.
Yeah, and you look at what's happened there. You've got someone with zero knowledge who's gone to essentially being a property developer, doing a subdivision in 18 months and making $200,000 over the same time period. Lack of knowledge, as you say, Brendan, is not an excuse. You can always learn. The final area, or the final fatal excuse, is the relationships one. Now, you spoke through this a little bit earlier, Brendan, so we've kind of come full circle. For those who feel that their partners aren't on board, or maybe have friends who are not interested or even negative about what they want to do with their property investing, what would you suggest that people do if they find themselves in that circumstance? They've not got people close to them who are supportive.
In most people's domestic lives, there are very few people who they can call on for property experience. If 95% of the population aren't in property or even aren't in investing, then goes to say that 95% of people's relationships don't have people in there that are doing this. Now, if you're one of those people, then it's important to get in front of people who are doing this so you can talk about your ideas, talk about what you can do, how you can make it work for you. And if you're around people willing to share this information, that's gold. You can be in a positive relationship around property or a relationship that's negative around property, or even a neutral one. So usually those people who are negative are those who are, "You know what, I don't like the change in you because it's affecting me, and therefore I'm going to bag what you're doing so that I don't have to face my own inadequacies and the fact that I'm not on my own financial freedom path, so I'm going to bring you down with me." Now, they don't say that out loud. They say, "You know what, come down to the pub and we'll go for a drink." Or, "What, you're missing the game again?" That's the sorts of questions you'll get. If you're around like-minded people, if you're around people who are on a path similar to you, if you're around people who are dedicated towards a better financial future for themselves, then the questions that they'll be asking are different. The questions they'll be asking are, "Do you want to come to an open inspection with me? You know, let's go and play Cashflow 101. Let's talk about where our finances are. Why don't we do a deal together?" You know, those sorts of questions will be existing rather than, "Let's go for a drink." It's incredibly important to have people around you that are like-minded and supportive of themselves and you towards achieving financial freedom.
And those people are certainly out there. I mean, we see it all the time in the community forums and the get-togethers for results, but there are investor support groups in every state and most cities. There will be like-minded people that you can get yourself amongst, and we highly advocate networking with other investors and other people who are on a similar path to what you want to be on to overcome that if you've got a lack of that in your own circle. Now, we got to start to wrap this up. So bringing this to a conclusion then, that there are going to be any number of reasons or excuses that you can put up for yourself to say, I can't do it. And there's a reason why I carry a little fortune cookie slip around in my wallet. A few years ago, when we were out to dinner with some of our investor friends, we were sitting around at a dinner table, and this restaurant had fortune cookies. And I opened mine up, and this little slip of paper fell out. And I've kept it with me to this day because it really does encapsulate everything that we're talking about today. And the fortune cookie says simply, those who say it can't be done are usually interrupted by someone actually doing it. And that's become really words to live by for me. There is always a way to overcome any excuse or any obstacle if it's important enough for you to try. That comes back to financial goals. If we look at what all the people we've spoken about today have in common, they have persistence, determination, discipline, and a willingness to make sacrifices, but all as a result of really wanting to achieve their financial goals. Their goals are that important to them that no matter what the resistance that gets put up, whatever the excuses that comes up that they could use to stop, they don't. They find a way to go on, or they ask for help to find a way to go on. Now, all of those examples, as we mentioned, have been drawn from our results members because they're the people that we coach, and some of them are also in the book. But we've actually just opened enrolments for the 2011 results mentoring program as well, and there's a limited opportunity right now for a small number of people to start the program early. And so if this is of interest to you, if you are the sort of person who really wants to make a difference in your life, then you're the sort of person that we're looking for. We want a limited number of people who are really determined to make a change in their lives to join the program early. So think about it. Imagine what you could do with the same sort of one-on-one mentoring from the team that the guys we've spoken about today on the webinar have done. You'd be able to face down those excuses. You'd have somebody there to help you stay accountable to what you're trying to achieve with your financial goals, to help you brainstorm ideas for overcoming obstacles, and help you take your investing to levels that maybe you haven't even dreamt are possible. Now, our full program isn't going to begin until 1 July next year. So the opportunity that we've just made available for those who are committed to making the necessary sacrifices and changes in their lives is to get in now. And so there's an early bird offer available. Now, benefits of that, Brendan, help me out here. They'll get a head start, won't they? What's the start date for the early birds?
Well, as you say, the program formally begins on 1 July, but if you are one of those people who really wants to take control and make a difference in your own life quick and are keen to start now, the early bird pack, that starts on 1 January. You get an extra 6 months of the network support. You get an extra 6 months of access to the materials that could make that difference for you.
So what does that encapsulate, that 6 months then?
Okay, so you get the right people in your life. You start to manage your time and your money. We give templates for budgeting in time. So there's time management components. You get support for templates around looking at deals and deal analysis. There is a pile of information in audios and webinars. I mean, 5+ years of webinars are sitting there waiting for you to tap into, not unlike this, with different messages on all aspects of property investing. So you can learn new strategies. You can delve into different strategies and hear firsthand of people who have done them, how to do them. And that's just at your fingertips.
Brendan, you mentioned templates there for analysing deals. Now, those are the same templates that we use. They're the ones that we've put together for our own deals and our own projects, yes?
Oh, absolutely. We've refined the process so it's just simply plug in a few numbers and a number spits out the bottom, and then you say, you know what, this deal has merit to keep investigating. And that's what it's all about. It's a car bonnet approach that it says, yes, I'm in, let's talk. You have access to that. If you want to do this, these are the tools available to you, and they're available to you from January 1. We'll have a form of group support where you will hear webinars not dissimilar to this, but one a month for 6 months. It's going to allow you to get a head start before the program actually begins.
Now, those are Q&A type webinars as well, aren't they? So it's a form of group coaching.
Indeed. People will either call in or enter their questions on the webinar as they did today, and we'll respond in real time to your question so that we can help you as a group so that others can learn from the wisdom that you're asking about to get started on their own investing.
What if somebody's listening to you, Brendan, and thinking, that's great, but what if I've got an urgent need? So if the full coaching program doesn't start till 1 July, what if I actually have an offer that I want to put on a property, or I'm selling a property in the meantime?
At a pinch, no problem. We don't want you to make a bad investing decision. If you're about to sign on the dotted line, if you're about to seriously consider a purchase offer, please give us a call. We would rather have the conversation with you than you feeling too embarrassed to ask. It's like those ads on telly at the moment that say, you know, don't burn yourself with a boiling pot of hot water. Ask.
Yeah, I mean, there's not a lot that we can do after the fact, but we can certainly provide you with whatever we can in the way of our experience or our knowledge before you actually make the final decision. So for those who do come in as early birds, that option is available if you find yourself in a pinch, if you need some urgent support. Even though the full coaching hasn't really started, we're not hard people about that. We will do whatever we can to move heaven and earth to accommodate.
So what do people need to do, my friend?
All right, well, look, if you are ready to make this sort of a massive change in your life, and if you want that support that the results team can offer you, then there are only, I think, at last look, 39 of these early bird spots remaining. And in order to take advantage of that, you need to go to resultsmentoring.com/programs/RP7-EBS. Now, I'll type that into the chat room window at the end of this, but you need to go to that website. There are only those 39 spots. They're only available until December 31, if they're not gone before then, which they may well be. And once they're gone, that's it. We will not be taking more people into the program until, what, after March?
Yeah.
So this is a key chance to get in right now, get in 6 months ahead of the start of the full program, get all of that extra support, basically have an 18-month program instead of a 12-month program at the what's essentially the lowest possible price.
Now, we've had people in the past who have done early birds. We had an early bird program for the current results program, and not one person, to my knowledge, not one person has ever said, you know what, that was a bad decision. Anybody who has enrolled in the early bird program and received all that additional bonus material, bonus access, has enjoyed and reveled in it and given themselves a head start well before the program begins. If it's something you want to do, can I implore you to take action now rather than delay?
Excellent. All right, we've got to wrap it up. We're way over time, so some quick closing thoughts from me, really. What excuses are you putting in the way? And challenge yourself. How real are those excuses? Is there one action that you could take right now to start to overcome the barriers that you think you're facing? Figure out what that one action is, no matter how small it is, and go and do it. Do it today. And you'll notice a whole new world of opportunity opens up before you. Lynn, final thoughts.
Well, I thought it was interesting, the title for today's webinar. A is for attitude. And I can't stress enough how keeping a positive attitude, everything that you look to do to be moving forwards and keeping that positive sort of outlook on life. Another A word I thought of was be aware. Aware of what's coming out of your mouth with regard to your attitude. Is it an excuse? Can I turn that around into a positive statement and not a negative? The other thing that I like to do is every year I come up with a positive catch cry for myself. And this year's positive catch cry is nothing is impossible. Sure, there's going to be things that are going to be obstacles, but nothing is impossible. And sure, if you come across some obstacles, well, how can I make this happen? How can I get around it and get over it and move on? So can you think of a positive affirmation moving forwards to help you keep a positive attitude?
Brendan.
Commitment. Everything's going to extend back to your level of commitment to you and the goals that you want to achieve, the financial position you want you and your family to be in. It all comes down to commitment. So check your own level of commitment. Are you dawdling? Are you dwindling? If your commitment's faint, then reinvigorate it, re-inspire it, because without the level of commitment to follow through, you simply won't. So be committed. Take action and be committed. Those that are committed will have a far, far greater chance of success and ultimately will than those who are not. So check your level of commitment.
Wise words indeed. Thank you, Brendan. Thank you, Lynn. Thank you, everybody, for participating in the webinar today. I hope you found this to be of value, and we look forward to catching up with you again in the not-too-distant future. All the best, and remember, invest wisely.